Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might have.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
And this is Veronica Monet. This is the Shame-Free Zone. It's another Monday night. Got a little bit of a controversial topic tonight. We're going to be talking about kink and fetish and BDSM. And if you don't know what those words are, don't worry. My guest is going to help define them. I've already got something of a controversy going on my Facebook page. That's what I like to see. Lots of comments here. So without further ado, let me tell you a little bit about the guest. His name is Galen. He's actually the author of a book called The Sharp Edge of Love. And he's also designed a lightweight freestanding suspension bondage rig, which is called the Tetris Portable. I'm thinking there's been a few times I could have used one of those. Anyway, welcome to the show, Galen. I really appreciate you joining me in the Shame Free Zone.
Rock, it's a pleasure to be here this evening.
I think you and I have quite a few friends in common. My cousin up in Seattle, I think you're friends with Alina.
Yes.
Yeah. Everybody's friends with Alina.
Yeah, she knows many people.
She really
more than I do.
More than anybody I know, frankly. Now, you've got a kind of a mentoring, coaching approach to this topic. So you're actually helping people to get in touch with the spiritual, psychological, emotional, even mystical and ritual aspects of Eros. Is that true?
Yes, all of those and maybe even more, because that's how rich and how much depth there is in my experience, unfortunately, in our culture, is that we really are taught very little about what sexuality is or much about what it's about or even have it talked about at all. I liked in the introduction one of the words I heard that made me feel more comfortable was that this is a safe place. And that's really, I think, the foundation of what's missing in our culture is a safe place, or many safe places, for people who are involved in what I'll call fetish-oriented sexuality, things that are generally considered taboo, forbidden, inappropriate by the parent culture. But yet, this is a persistent, authentic, true aspect of someone's sexuality, and they know either instinctually or from experience that it's not safe to tell my wife or my most intimate partner. It's not safe to tell my parents. It's not safe to talk to my kids about it. It's not safe to talk to my pastor or my boss or my coworkers, or, you know, there's nowhere safe that's sanctioned, you know, that's very visible for people to take these hidden desires. They're not hidden. Their desires are the desires, but the part that's stymied in our culture is the fact that it is hidden to a great extent. And this aspect of fetish, you know, my senses, won't go into the great scientific details, but somewhere between 30% and 40% possibly of the world's population as a kink fetish-oriented sexuality to some degree or another. And that's a pretty large chunk of humanity that is culturally forced to hide what they're doing at great risk if they don't. You know, people can become ostracized, lose their jobs, be kicked out of communities. It's intense what can be just for simply wanting to be true to who they are.
Well, let's define a few terms for our listeners before we dive too deep into this, because you really do cover quite a bit of this. You talk about shadow work, voice dialogue, depth psychology, conscious movement, conscious touch, neo-tantra, DNS, BDSM, shamanism, And then, of course, a variety of ritual practices. First of all, let's define DNS for people. Dominance and submission, but can you give us some, in one or two sentences, what's a definition of that so that people who aren't familiar with it will have a better understanding?
Yeah. Well, it's a relationship style between two people that is consensually entered into in a negotiated way where one partner is aspiring to the dominant role, i.e. in control, expressing their leadership, their vision, their ability to organize and bring about and take into action their vision, whereas the submissive is consciously aspiring to be in a role of service, devotion, surrender, support, nurturing. So that's in a kind of a, and that could be in a relationship that's, a full-time relationship, or it can be just in a negotiated scene that two people to get together. Or it doesn't even need to be erotic necessarily. Someone could be just totally into it for the service aspect for them, or for someone who's really aspiring to their leadership and is maybe, the interesting thing about this path, if either of those sides, one chooses to be a dominant or a submissive, they're going to confront all the parts of them that aren't dominant or aren't submissive, in their aspiration. So that adds an interesting twist to the possibilities of what can benefit from following that path.
You indicated some people can do this in a play space, which that would be considered like a scene. You would create a scene, negotiate a scene. But the other, you said they might do this every day as part of their life, and oftentimes we refer to that as lifestyle. Can you give us a little idea of how somebody who might be lifestyle would be different than somebody who just enjoys playing?
Yeah, well, someone, the difference would be primarily in terms of sexuality. There are many people, there's a lot fewer people who are into the DS side as a relationship style than there are people who are into the DS side as a sexual practice. There are many people who are what you might call tops or bottoms, which means generally that they're not submissive or dominant, but they like in a scene to take one role or the other. Or some people switch and can, modulate between those roles. But it's the element of it that's there always is one dominates, one submits.
Yes, exactly. And so, for instance, in a play space, is it more likely to have erotic overtones and be kind of sexually oriented, or...
Yeah, I mean, it would be kind of a pure fetish of someone who simply, in a non-erotic way, simply wants to enter a space and just to have a dominant and submissive context going on, whatever that might look like. It might be domestic chores or such things, gardening, doing the shopping, repairing things, administrative duties, and there are actually some percentage of people who do engage in that way. Just they have a fetish for service. They get off on being in service or in control in a real specific way.
Right. And if your lifestyle, obviously, it's not always sexual. It has an awful lot to do with the roles that you enjoy engaging in with your partners.
Yeah, and this has, from my experience and how I look at it, this has a really beautiful, mythic, noble quality to it that two people can engage in this mythos of dominance and submission. And as I look at it, is in the dominant side, the person on that side can be aspiring to the archetype of the king or the queen, which is a very powerful mythos, in our collective and our individual consciousness that's been around for thousands of years. It's a very powerful state of mind to put oneself into, and it's a very tough, it's not an easy path, it's either of these paths are not easy, because if you're going to aspire to be a dominant, that means, you are aspiring to be a leader, to be in integrity, to be accountable, to be responsible, to take care of your property, to manage well, to make wise choices. Those are all very noble characteristics, to be benevolent, to bless, you know, to bring joy. That's a pretty tall order for someone to step into that. But, and that's the other part of it. It's a path. It's not a destination. You know, these are things to aspire to. And so that nobility can be entered into in relationship and can be very fulfilling for both sides, especially if they have already instinctive tendencies to one pole or the other of those. It can be very calming and, you know, peaceful as much as it people are going to freak out about being controlled. I mean, it's also very complex. What I'm speaking of is also an ideal state. I mean, there's a long path of negotiation before a couple would enter or be able to hold successfully that type of dynamic. You know, it's very complex, obviously. And it is fraught with issues, you know, that of all the parts of someone who aspires to be leadership, who is, you know, has the shadow of the weakling or the tyrant or, you know, such other dimensions are there. So it's great in that sense from how I look at it, how I work with it, because it's going to confront me with all the things that I still have to work on in myself, parts of myself that are unresolved, you know, and for me that's part of the journey is to resolve those.
Well, you know, Galen, some of the roles about being the dominant, it's interesting because a lot of times the stereotype, of course, about a dominant is that, you know, that they are perhaps being abusive. You know, that, I think that's sometimes, you know, where people will go with that. But there's actually research that came out of the University of Arizona, I believe, a couple of years ago, where they found that the physiological responses of a submissive are actually incredibly healthy and favorable. So there's like stress reduction and the release of all kinds of endorphins and hormones that create improved health and a better mental outlook even, which I think is kind of surprising. And then you add to that the fact that really the dominant person, is usually very much in service to their submissive. You're working very hard to keep that that scene going in a way that works for the submissive. Would you agree with that, or are you familiar with the research?
Yeah, there's a lot of responsibility there. There's a lot of skill to be brought to it. You know, it's even there's the challenge of receiving, you know, that the dominant needs to learn. You know, so for many people, especially, you know, in my experience as a guy raised in the 50s, you know, this kind of self-reliant type of ingrained part of me that, you know, doesn't need anything. You know, I can be like a lizard on a rock in the sun, you know, just that's it. And Spartan attitude. So to learn how to receive. It's ironic I say that sitting in a duck pond in Oregon. But, so there's another kind of a beautiful part of this ritual path as well is, you know, really consciously and intentionally letting oneself receive, you know, what the submissive can offer them in their service. You know, some people are very, it's tough to receive. Just like it can be looked at upon as, well, it's tough to be giving all the time. It can be tough to receive, too, for people. So there's subtleties and nuances and that are all to be had and gained in this process and the relationship side of things.
It's it is, and it's a much more complex issue than most. You know, I'd say the vanilla people. Let's explain some more of these terms. What does it mean when we say vanilla?
Well, I guess I would refer to that as just what the mainstream cultural mythos is of, you know, a heterosexual, missionary position, sex for procreation primarily, kind of attitude is, be, you know, maybe that's more the bottom line of it, you know, and it kind of evolves or has stages from there that, you know, don't quite cross into the kink fetish oriented realm yet, but are pretty would be considered acceptable, you know, so to speak, in the mainstream culture.
More mainstream. And yet, oftentimes, people who think of themselves as being quote-unquote normal or average in their sexual taste do employ some things that are a little bit kinky or kind of on the edge there, whether it's maybe blindfolding their lover or tying their hands with, you know, a silk scarf.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely, you know, far removed from the more extreme forms of BDSM, but would you agree that there's a little element of that in all sexuality?
I would, and the thing is that, so I think kink, fetish, you know, these different edges are everywhere, and because they're grounded, founded mostly in the unconscious, this is what the difference is, I think, with what is getting defined as the fetish world, is fetish is are people who are consciously cultivating their desires, whatever those might look like. Whereas in the vanilla world, they aren't really talked about, really shared. You know, it's happening silently. Their partners aren't even telling each other what's going on in their erotic mythos internally. You know, sometimes that doesn't show up. Well, you'll get a clue to this idea that I speak of, which I haven't really spoke too much yet, about this idea of erotic mythos. If I look at it when I was myself vanilla, say, you know, in that last 30 seconds before I'd get off is where I would embody, you know, this, you know, shit, fuck, bitch, god, you know, just some sort of explosion of some part of me was suddenly embodying, but it, you know, was held off for the last second. So that's like the tip of the iceberg. It's like a zip file that's compressed down, and it's a little glimpse that's finally liberated from all the ways that it's been held back and hidden and repressed. And in that 30 seconds is when most people in the villa world really are authentically being who they are sexually. Some part of them, anyway, showing up that isn't there the rest of the time. My premise is that that's the glimpse. You know, this could be a 4 or 5 hour experience instead of a 30-second experience if you really opened up to what is really going on there in your personal myth. You know.
Well, can we also define the word fetish? How does that differ from kink? Or
I don't know if it does, really. You know, some of these, yeah, there's a lot of crossover. At least I wouldn't make a big distinction between the two. I think fetish, you know, fetish has kind of a clinical term, you know, in the DSM perspective of, you know, which would be an erotic fixation on a non-erotic object or practice.
Right, like a fetish for women's high heels or something like that, right?
Yes. I think it's though, and more has broadened to really define what would be the equivalent of the gay and lesbian movement in the 50s and 60s. I think this is all of the elements of kink, fetish, DS, BDSM, cross-dressing, transvestiteism, polyamory, all of those aspects, I think, could be and should be in some way under the umbrella of fetish, because there is some element of this as a culture, you know, that's getting defined here. It's still not really organized, especially, you know, the way the gay and lesbian community got organized and politically and socially and in other ways, you know, to establish themselves, to defend or protect or petition for their rights, et cetera. I think the same thing is needs to evolve, and I think it is evolving in among what I'm calling the fetish community to respond to the things that the conservative, religious, and governmental elements would like to put a cap back on all of this sexual expression that's going on in the world right now.
True enough. You know, we've got quite a few comments here on Facebook, but there's one technical question. So while we're defining terms, I just want to... Seth asks this. He wants to know, is BDSM suspension related at all to the body modification suspension?
Well, I think he would be referring to, like, the primitive use of hook suspension and things. I got the sense of that from the question.
I'm just guessing. You're probably right about that, but I don't know. Are you thinking like Native American?
Well, I wonder if he meant, is it like a ritual kind of suspension that primitives have used to reach ecstatic states or transcendent states? If that was the question, to some extent, that can be it. It might not be someone's intention for that. It might be more sexual play oriented or there's a certain aesthetic and visual art to suspension bondage that a lot of people aspire to. So there's a lot of mythical qualities, metaphorical, symbolic elements that can be applied to suspension bondage. It may, it all depends on one's intention in the moment.
So, okay. Between his question and your answer, I'm a little confused.
Synergy. No,
yeah, really. Look on the bright side there.
Yeah.
So let me see if I get what you're saying. You're saying that if Seth was referring to something like Native American sun dancers, that some BDSM activities can bring that element of ritual in as well. Is that true?
Yes, there's the sense of the ordeal, there's the sense of endurance, many of the same elements that are, transcendent of, pain or intense sensation, and a strong intention to transcend something.
Right, and this is actually an area of your expertise, is the whole idea of using, dark eros in order to transcend. True?
Well, I think that can, again, it's about intention. I don't say that it should be. Many people, as you spoke to earlier, they just want to, maybe on a weekend sometime I might like to get blindfolded or have my hands tied, and maybe they don't need or want to, or that's true. That's the extent of how that's true for them, whereas other people want to use this as a tool to reach deeper places within themselves, to empower themselves, to heal themselves, to journey into the unknown and the wilderness and explore what's there, to connect with a partner in a really amazingly intimate and deep way. All those are possible.
So Seth was trying to help us here a little bit by further defining his question. Sent me a link to Miss Crash's suspension show. Are you familiar with that?
I am not.
No. Well, it's very interesting. She suspended herself by her knees, her elbows, and also her rib cage area. Some pretty nasty looking hooks here.
Yeah.
And it's a performance that looked to be like hundreds of people watching this.
Yeah, they are mesmerizing. I've been to those, and they are, it's astounding. These are practices that, primitives and Native American and indigenous cultures have used, for thousands of years. And it's pretty courageous for a bunch of urban, primitives to kind of step into these really intense physical ordeals, as much as it might be a lark or something that somebody just, I want to experience that. My witnessing of them is that you can't help but fall into the ritual energy of it. It's going to take somebody to an altered experience, that they're not getting in the other parts of the cultural experience.
Well, now this is something that probably needs a little explaining. I mentioned some of the research coming out of Arizona about the chemicals that are released in the body, but maybe you could actually just give us a little bit more information about that, because the administration of pain does alter the state of consciousness. And how would you describe that?
Well, you know, what's going on is sensation. And the interpretation is either pain or pleasure.
Right.
But it's still just sensation. And so one orientation, you know, if the body is tense, if the mind is tense, if the person doesn't feel safe, doesn't feel connected, doesn't feel trusting, most people are going to have a much lower pain tolerance under those conditions. Their body and mindset is in a place that they want to get out of there. And there is a trend going the other way where this sensation is producing a response that is somebody feeling like they want to, like, toughen themselves up. They want to endure. They want to, you know, this is like a warrior challenge, you know, to some part of their spirit to take that on. And they're embodying this warrior state of consciousness, this fierce deployment of not of fighting the attacker, but of surrendering to the attacker and the sensation. Mm-hmm. And that can lead to places beyond that initial place of wanting to run and, oh, this just fucking hurts and I can't take it.
Right.
To the sensation transforms into this more void state. It's not necessarily pleasure or pain, but it's just like kind of narcotic, otherworldly, you know, but a certain sense that there's a kind of the center of a hurricane, you know, there's a calmness in the center of all this that's taking place. Maybe the first time someone's really gotten present. This is so physical, because it's so physical, and the body is the grounding place of being present. You know, the deeper we can get into our bodies, the more present we are going to be, the more enlivened we are going to feel. So for some people who live in our culture, we live in our heads. Most of us haven't really understood that we even have a body yet.
Mm-hmm.
And to get this much intense physical sensation is bringing many people the only channel they can find to really get out of their head and just into their body, which is, you know, being present and in this state. They've also likely surrendered. And then this is also the place now where the endorphins and all these biochemicals are starting to flood the system as well, which all support all the things I've just said biochemically.
And it's also, I think, really helpful for people who have obsessive-compulsive thoughts or obsessive thoughts of, you know, it may not actually be technically OCD, but they're still given to playing certain thoughts over and over in their head, or perhaps getting fixated on particular life events that might have been problematic. I think I've seen it really give people an outlet to where, at least while they are in that session or that scene, they seem to experience some relief that they don't the rest of their waking day.
Yeah, and you know, that's a you know, that's the sledgehammer technique to getting present, kind of, you know. But it does work, and that is for some people that is the only way that they know so far, you know. But this is also kind of leading into this conversation about the body generally and about this idea of being present and about slowing down everything to get into this state where one can really engage who they are authentically or sexually, you know, erotically, and this idea of the mythos. But to even just open that gateway to the body working, what I do with the clients that I work with, one part of it, or the fundamental part, the first part, is really about the body and helping them learn techniques and practices. I think everybody should be doing, working on this to get in deeper in connection with their body, breathing, movement, you know, pace, slowing of the pace of movement. All these things can help one get out of the stories of the future and the past that are just running wild in our minds most of the time.
Sure, they're meditation techniques.
Yes, any of those tools, I recommend, encourage, you know, people to explore things more engaging in their body. You know, this is really our bodies are so rich in the experience they can offer us, not just sexually, but just in terms of getting present and connecting and understanding and, you know, of being aware of our bodies is a really potent experience and a soothing and peaceful experience.
Well, and speaking more to, again, I think this tension that we often feel between what is considered more vanilla or mainstream sexual approach and the kinkier side of life. There's a comment from Lauren, and here's a question that I put out. I said, is it possible to express kink, fetish, and sadism in a way which is both emotionally healthy and incredibly loving? And this was Lauren's response. In my world, those are somewhat mutually exclusive, but mine is not the only experience set in the world. I worry where the line ends up being between being a recipient of this sadistic, painful, humiliating behavior nurtures me, and I'm enabling an abuser, and the denial inherent in the latter. There are a lot of gray areas there, in my opinion. Others' mileage may vary. This brings up a really interesting point, which is, you know, I've met some people who are lifestyle, who I really felt were perpetuating abusive patterns from a dysfunctional background. And how would you speak to that?
Well, I think that's a really good point, and that is why it's important to recognize, yeah, this isn't easy. This is complex territory, and it is a spiritual, a psychological, an emotional, a physical journey. All those aspects are going to be involved in. It takes a high level of personal awareness, I think. It has to be a conscious practice. You know, none of us are going to be perfect. You know, as I said, it's a path, not a destination. But with any path that we are on, it is important to practice it in a conscious way. So that means, this is almost too complex to really tackle in a succinct way. The caller's, Lauren's questions are excellent and very perfect and critically important for someone to be safe in carrying this journey out, for both parties to be safe in exploring these things. So as a conscious practice, that means it's, you talk about with your partner all of these concerns. You know, if your partner can't talk with you openly about your concern, geez, I was a little afraid that I didn't feel connected to you anymore while you were, you know, beating the shit out of me. You know, were you really there or were you not? You know, these are important. Both sides need to be able to create a ritual space where they can bring, when things are getting a little fuzzy or a little confusing or not there, that both sides, either side, can call a timeout and say, I'd like to, you know, I want to end what's going on here. There's something up for me that I'd like to take time now and just open up to it and talk and see what happened and what we can do from there. And that kind of discussion always has to be going on in these types of relationships to keep, because we both have, as I talked about, shadow of the archetype of the king or the queen is the tyrant on the one hand and the weakling on the other. All of us are going to have these shadowy parts of us along for the ride here. You know, we need to be paying attention to our shadow as well as what our intention is as we journey down these paths. You know, these are very subtle things, and we can easily get tangled up in all this stuff in our relationships if we're not able to differentiate these parts and learn about them and be more aware of them, which can occur through this type of communication with your partner that I'm speaking to.
And I think that, you know, the important thing here to note is that, especially when you're doing something as dangerous as some of the kink and BDSM techniques, I mean, they are potentially dangerous. You really need to have done your homework emotionally and spiritually and psychologically. And then, of course, you also need to get extensive training in some of these techniques. You know, even something as deceptively simple as flogging has, you know, the potential to put out an eye or damage a kidney if you don't know what you're doing. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, there's safety on a number of levels. You know, the first, most obvious level, and the one that the scene, you know, the DSC, like you talked about before, of, you know, there's different kinds of aspects of the fetish scene that have, that are in place and that have happened and that have really brought things to a, there's some good rules of practice. They call it best practices already established in these areas. And so every implement, you know, has kind of its safety orientation, you know, so someone wanting to get into flogging, you can find all these things online. They're going to be all over the place if you do a search of the technique of flogging, you know, what at least is known, you know, about where it's safe to hit and the thuddy versus stingy and different elements of that. Same thing with the single tail and the cane and needle play, and all of these things have a really well-developed public domain level information pool about how to approach these things. And most all of them would say probably it would be best to go somewhere and see a demonstration from somebody who knows what they're doing and learn hands-on that way.
So I think the best actually is to be mentored by a pro dom so that you can do some hands-on while you're training, because until you've actually handled the equipment and the flesh that you're working with, I think, you know, it's doesn't translate all that well from paper to practice.
Yeah, and that's another brings up another important point about where we began this part of the conversation with about, I think, Lauren's questions. There was the other part of this between partners is what I would call pace. You know, so if you and your partner are going to start to explore some aspect of BDSM-oriented sexuality, the first thing is you're going to negotiate what's going to go on and what's not going to go on in the scene between you.
Mm-hmm.
The other part, though, is, and this is more on the dominant side to pay attention to, is what I'll call the idea of pace, which means when I'm working with someone new and they tell me their edges or their boundaries or what they're open to, first of all, I'll probably maybe pare that down to two or three things that in the first session we might do if they gave me a long list and they want to do everything. You know, just pick a few things to start with, try in your first scene with your partner, so to speak. Mm-hmm. The other thing is this idea of pace where, you know, if you're going to use an implement like a flogger or something, you know, start real light, obviously under, you know, what you believe would be under their tolerance. And just stay in that realm and just slowly move the pace up or the intensity up and check in. Say, so 1 to 10, you know, where are you at? So, you know, once you get more experience, you'll be able to kind of just look at somebody's body responses and pretty much tell where they're at, if you're still connected with them, if they're still riding the wave up versus they're starting to shut down or go somewhere else or whatever. So, but if you're not clear, ask,
yeah,
you know, check in, say hey.
Absolutely.
In ritual, the beautiful thing about ritual is you can do everything, anything in ritual. You're not going to, some people might be, well, I don't want to break the energy that we've got going here.
Right.
You can, I've done a lot of work in ritual, and things like I just said, stopping and checking in and asking, you don't skip a beat. You go right back to where you left off. And it's even, you can go deeper and it's stronger because there's more trust built by doing that. You're more clear about the information that what you sense you're interpreting.
Mm-hmm.
You're reinforcing your sensibilities, getting more confident, making corrections where you know, see things didn't. So pace is another key thing after you negotiate what can and cannot, should not, does not want to happen in the scene. Think about the pace and go slow, you know, and check in.
Yeah, and I alternating between soft and hard, and don't you think that that's very helpful too?
Yeah, on a novice side, I would just say until you really get more experience, just to always keep it slow. But in practical experience, I mean, someone, you know, I've had people, you know, within 5 seconds, they're, you know, they're ready to go to the edge. It's just clear. they don't need the we got the pace, you know, right through it. So
right.
It all depends on the person. But so because so many of us, we have so many levels of, trust and betrayal that has gone on in our lives, we're going to hit areas that are our big ones, and we want to know what they are so we can set a boundary and say, no, I don't want to go there. Or you can do these things really consciously at the beginning and say, no, I don't want to do any, okay, so here's one thing I check in with someone I'm going to work with in these more edgier areas of humiliation play. Now, in some regards, just there being a dominant submissive dynamic, there's a certain element of, that diminished role of beneath and at the bottom that, I can't say that it's not humiliation, Some people can say, oh, I'm not into humiliation, but they're willing to be, used, taken control of, or whatever, and to them they won't say that that's humiliation. So people need to really understand, what does someone mean when they, say, I don't want to be humiliated?
Right. Definitions are very important. Everybody's got a different one. Or oftentimes people do. Where that line is, varies from person to person. What about...
And language is very... Let me finish that point, though, because language is very important here, and getting into these roles and these mythos and these archetypal characters, there's a lot of richness there, but there's also a lot of people who... it takes some practice to really let these things show up in the right way, and also in a way that's safe with somebody's partner. So because we are often language-oriented in these exchanges, you need to check in on what I check in with someone on. So do you have any issues around language that deal with body image, femininity, gender, worthiness, intelligence, spirituality or religion, race?
Right.
I found in that range of there, people would say they could pick out like a menu, don't call me stupid, but you can call me a fat pig.
Yeah.
I'll fucking kill you if you call me stupid, but if you call me a fat pig, my cunt's going to drip and I'm going to get all horny and, it'll be great.
Right.
As odd as that might sound to some people, the elements of humiliation and degradation can be very strong for them. And that's why it's hard, especially when somebody carries some energy like that, some spirit, some erotic part. That's why it's so challenging in our culture for people like that, even though it's the truth for them, to own that, someplace. It takes a very intimate, trusting thing for people to even say that that is a desire that they have. But there are people who desire that. Prevalence of rape fantasy and gangbang and on and on.
Yep, there absolutely is. I'm going to read another comment from Facebook. Eric says, I've seen BDSM play very positive and nurturing, even sacred, and I've seen it horrifyingly abusive and demeaning. I think the intent we bring is far more important than the stereotypes or categories that we put particular behaviors in. A look at people's marriages shows that what's fine in one house can be a deal breaker in another. And what about that? When kink or BDSM becomes horrifyingly abusive and demeaning, how does one even define that? If the culture kind of sees blood, sees bruises, and calls that horrifying and demeaning. So, how does one redefine or draw that line so that we understand the difference between kink and BDSM that is working the way that is, positive for both players, or operating in a way that is destructive for the participants? How do you make that distinction?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question and an important question, and it's a very complex question as well, because, there's clearly could be a case where someone is theoretically consenting, but someone outside could be accurately saying, wow, that person is getting exploited. Maybe they're right. However, the opposite can be true as well. It's very hard to tell, you know, with down at these levels, you know, of where someone is consenting. They're saying they are, but are they, have they lost touch with reality and don't know they're being exploited? But the thing that happens, though, that's a little messy here is because it's about sexuality, and it's particularly fetish or taboo-oriented sexuality, the truth is all of these things go on in the vanilla world perpetually. You know, I mean, abuse and exploitation and taking advantage of another and all of that is rampant in the vanilla, you know, marriages and relationships that are out there. But and people don't get so horrified, you know, or, you know, there's a certain horror that gets cast onto this if it's in a sexual context versus people in their relationships all the time are exploiting each other or not being in integrity with each other or being dangerous or abusive with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So the sexual thing is the difference there. And so it makes a little more, people are harder in some ways to accept that somebody could have a consensual desire to be a slave to another person, to be someone who, you know, is bruised by another person through some impact play or another.
People are spending lots of money to be treated that way.
Yes.
You know? There's a market for it.
It's a profession that's built up around people find, you know, these are, that's why they're, you know, what's interesting to me, and I mean, it is like ritual sanctuaries that, you know, like pro-dominatrixes and such,
mm-hmm.
establish it within the culture where people can privately go express these true parts of themselves. You know, this has been going on for millennia, thousands and thousands of years. This isn't new stuff. The only difference is it's been so hidden in the past. Now it's suddenly becoming visible. You know, it used to be just you would see the preacher or the politician or the entertainer busted, you know, doing some derelict, you know, deviant behavior, sexual behavior.
Exactly.
But they're just the tip of the iceberg. You know, it's every, you know, the world right now is awash in fetish desire showing up all over the planet. It's never happened in the history of civilization that there's this much sexuality coming alive on the planet. It's quite an amazing thing, really. And
well, since you mentioned,
it's also, and it's a very adolescent stage too. It's still very teenagerish. You know, the way we are operating, it's operating right now. It's not, you know, we're,
yeah.
The maturity is still yet to happen because it's so new. It's like, so people are just so, you know, are like out there being teenagers because, wow, I can, my sexuality can go out and play right now. And
when you refer to that, are you talking about the focus on sensation and violating taboos as opposed to actually going deep into the spiritual and ritualistic aspects?
That is true, that part. But there's also this adolescent in that there's so much lack of integrity out there in terms of people, you know, on the internet of, you know, people deceiving, you know, not being who they say they are, not being married and saying they aren't, and all of
right.
this thing. So, but while people are still trying to, I think it's the sadness around it is there's so much, it's just somebody's honest sexuality asking to be okay that they can express it.
Right.
And because it's so not allowed, it comes out in creates all these shadowy, hidden, secretive, behind the back kind of ways that it leaks out, and people invariably get busted, and it's a real vicious cycle and painful one in that, simply because we can't be honest. You know, which brings up a whole thing about our old dating process, is that we marry and mate with people, we scrutinize them up and down, but we never ask them, so what kind of sex do you like? How often do you like sex?
so
you know,
true.
And you get married, and for the next 40, 50 years that you're alive, you had to just squelch your sexuality because your partner didn't go for it.
Yes,
you're expected just to
give it up. It's so true, Galen. I see a lot of that in my office all week long, couples who cannot talk about the sex that they're actually having with each other. It's very sad. You know, we're starting to get down to the last 5 minutes of this program, and I actually want to give people a chance to hear just a little bit about your book, The Sharp Edge of Love. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that was a book I published in 2001, I think. It was very closer to the front end of my journey, but I had some pretty interesting experiences with some pretty amazing women that I wrote the book actually to honor the truth of their sexuality is, you know, perverse and over the edge that it might have been. And as well as, you know, kind of my own process that I was going through. But that book is then, I think, you know, I'm working on a new book now that I'm much more engaged in, and it deals in some ways with a lot of the things that we've been talking about. I think really there's a need for so much more education, and it's not even education. This is a wilderness. Sexuality is a wilderness, and it's just like the wilderness of any environment that, you know, there's a frontier up to the edge of it, and then the rest of it is who knows what's out there. Down in the depths of our unconscious parts, you know, there's these archetypes and personas that are there of, you know, the daddy-daughter, the dominant-submissive, the master-slave, the rapist-victim, the predator-prey. All of these are a rich element of our unconscious that are going on, and they're in the collective. I mean, they show up. It's amazing how many people can meet and match up, thanks to the internet now, with these pantheon of sexual fetishes and desires that there's actually counterparts for. And most people carry these internally, just their fantasies, and now they're being able to bring them out into the world and meet counterparts who've been carrying the same thing internally and now can embody in the real world. But yeah, there's a lot to go into, and I'm hoping to open some of those gateways up in this other book I'm working on now.
Well, I'm sure you will. You're very thorough, and I think that's so important when people are seeking information about an area of sexual practice, which is so incredibly complicated, as it is with BDSM especially. And I want to make sure listeners know where they can find out more about you, because you do mentor and coach people who are interested in learning more about kink and dark arrows. The website is www.dakadom.com. That's dakadom.com. dakadom.com. And if you're interested in Galen's freestanding suspension bondage rig, you can find that over at www.tetris.com. That's spelled TETRUSS.com, tetris.com. Is there anything else you'd like them to know about how they can contact you?
Those two are good sources. You know, they can do a Google search on Dakadom or the Tetris and find me otherwise. And, yeah, I'm happy to talk with anybody.
You're located in Portland, Oregon?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, you and I haven't actually met face-to-face, but I'm coming up to Portland in July. We'll have to get together.
Yeah, for sure. I'd look forward to that. I've really enjoyed our chance to connect tonight.
Me too. You got a dungeon, I assume.
You bet. You're welcome to come visit.
I want a tour.
Yeah. Extensive. We'll give you the extensive tour.
Awesome. Okay. Well, now I'm a little bit worried.
There you are. Good. I like to move over here.
I'm sure you do. Galen, thank you so much for joining me in the shame-free zone. And
yes,
if you see my cousin before
place.
I do, give her a big hug and kiss for me.
I will.
Okay. And I want to thank all the people who participated on Facebook today. We had Tantra Healer and John and Sophie and Ben, and then, of course, Eric and Seth and Lauren. Thank you so much for all your comments. Didn't get all of them read on the air, but certainly made for some very interesting discussion tonight. I will be back here next week interviewing the fabulous and incredibly famous Susie Bright. She's on tour. She's got a brand new book. You definitely don't want to miss the show. See you next Monday. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak mutus kabar?